Thank you. Be seated.
The court is ready to hear argument from the lawyers in N. Ray Allstate.
May it please the court, Mr. Thomas Rogers and Mr. Reagan Brown will present argument for the relators. Relators have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Rogers will open with the first 15 minutes. Mr. Brown will present the rebuttal.
Chief Justice, members of the court, counsel, may it please the court. The ruling of the trial court that the appraisal provision, when considered as an arbitration provision, is unenforceable, ignores over 100 years of Texas jurisprudence enforcing appraisal provisions in insurance policies.
All right, well, what if we agreed with you on that?
I would be very pleased if you
could. But then where do we go from there? I mean, the trial court seems to have, the Court of Appeals seems, seems to have based its decision on that premise. And if we were to throw out that premise, then what sort of discretion does the trial court have on a discovery basis to say, as a matter of relevance to the issues involved, I'm not going to allow appraisal at this time? And how much can we review that under Walker versus Packer? Wouldn't there be an adequate remedy by appeal to review that type of decision?
Well, first, that's not what the trial court did here, Judge. The trial court found the appraisal provision unenforceable. Now, assume the trial court, as you suggest, found that the appraisal provision was enforceable. Does the trial court then have the discretion to stay that process until later in the proceeding?
Well, that's my question.
My answer to that is that, no, the trial court in this case doesn't have the discretion to determine that the appraisal process should take place later in the proceeding. In this case, the case has just commenced. No discovery had taken place. No pretrial conference has been set. No trial date has been set. The policy itself has a no-action clause in it that basically provides that no suit shall be brought against the insurer until all the terms of the policy have been complied with. The appraisal provision provides that we or you disagree as to the amount of loss, either may demand an appraisal.
But I guess my point is, as an evidentiary matter or as a legal condition precedent matter, aren't those reviewable on appeal? They wouldn't be mandamusable.
No, they're not reviewable on appeal, Judge. As Chief Justice Phillips observed in Walker versus Packer, the remedy by appeal is not adequate if the trial court's ruling vitiates or compromises the claim or defense of the party. The function of the appraisal provision here is that once the appraisal process takes place, it works as an estoppel as to the amount of damages. It provides the appraisal is binding on the parties.
Damages as to the loss itself.
As to the amount of loss only.
But the claims here are very different. The trial court could, in fact, decide to sever the loss claims. We're very early in the proceedings, and if the court were to sever the loss claims and focus only on the fraudulent practices here that are being claimed, then the discovery you're seeking wouldn't be relevant. So, again, I get to the question of mandamusable.
Yes, it is, because the determination of the amount of loss is the basic claim underlying not only their breach of contract cause of action, but all their experts.
But that's not, that's not the way I read their pleadings, though. I mean, they certainly have a breach of contract action with respect to the loss. The appraisal process is a means of resolving the dispute about the amount of the loss, but they're challenging the claims handling process at the front end and the way that the insurance company is responding to the claim when it is made and the procedures used to determine the value at that point in time, and then the insurance companies take it or leave it. We're going to cut off your other rights under the policy unless you take it. All of that comes very much before there's a dispute over the amount of loss under the policy. I fail to see the relevancy of the amount of the loss as determined by the appraisal process to the damages being claimed under the fraudulent practices theories, which seem to me to be the heart of the case.
Well, the heart of the case, Judge, all comes back to the amount of the loss, the determination of the actual cash value.
But that is resolved under the appraisal procedure, is we can't agree to how much we should pay you, so we get one appraiser, there's another appraiser. If they can't agree, then a third appraiser decides, and you're basically compromising at that point in time. That procedure is a very different issue than what the pleadings reflect in this case in terms of the damage being caused by the claims practicing handle, the claims handling practices. And the damages that are pled there are very different than the loss that would be determined under the policy using an appraisal process. I realize your briefs all talk about this is the loss, this is a breach of contract action. The pleadings seem to say something different. And that's what I'm having a hard time with.
The appraisal clause, which is part of the agreement of the parties, provides that upon demand, an appraisal shall occur. Now, if this court decides that by making extra contractual claims or filing a lawsuit, that the insurer can somehow circumvent or delay the appraisal process, then each and every time an insurer makes a demand for appraisal, the response of the insurer can simply be to file a lawsuit or to file a lawsuit that makes extra contractual
claims. But that's my question on mandamusability here. I mean, any determination of the value of the proof of the appraisal is a relevancy issue that I think would be within the discretion of the trial court, and therefore there would be an adequate remedy by appeal.
I disagree, Judge. The result of the appraisal works in estoppel. So let's assume in this case that the appraisal process took place and the appraisal came back with the same amount of actual cash value that each of the insurers determined.
But again, you're arguing relevance. You're saying that's why it's relevant and that's why we're entitled to it. And that's a trial court, a discretionary standard, what the trial court has ruled in terms of relevance.
Now, the trial court here has determined that the appraisal process is not going to take place at all.
And they expressed a reason for that in the order, and that was the basis of my question. If we were to find that the reason the court gave in the order is not valid, then what are we to do? Then does it come within the court's discretion to deny it on another ground that's not reviewable by mandamus?
I don't think it's within the court's discretion once the demand for appraisal has been made, even if litigation is commenced.
All right, tell me how you write that. Do you say, all right, we disagree with the arbitration piece. Now we take it upon ourselves to decide that this is relevant, critical evidence, condition precedent. You're asking us to then make that determination to get the relief that you want.
Yes, sir.
And those seem to me discretionary matters that are typically subject to appeal.
Well, by analogy to the arbitration agreement, this court in Jack B. England Company, Inc. versus TIF found that the trial court's denial of a motion to compel arbitration was subject to remedy by mandamus for the reason that Jack B. England Company, Inc., and this was a Jacksboro Dam case, ran the Jack B. England Company, Inc., would be deprived of the benefit of its bargain, which was a rapid, speedy, inexpensive determination of the dispute.
But that statement presupposes that the only dispute in this case, as Justice Hankin points out, is not the case, that the amount of the loss is the only issue between the parties.
Well, unlike the Texas Arbitration Act, and the Federal Arbitration Act, which provide a mechanism for judicial intervention when a party resists arbitration, the provision for the appraisal in the auto policy contains no such remedy. Therefore, the only remedy, which is to compel one or the other parties to appraisal, is the no-action clause in the policy.
But, Mr. England, it seems to me you can't have it both ways. On the one hand, you say it's not an arbitration clause, and Jack England is an arbitration case, and that's why mandamus was appropriate. So if this is like an arbitration clause, then perhaps you fall underneath Jack England, and the analysis would be something comparable to that. However, I understand you to say it's not an arbitration clause, and what we've got here is a breach of contract. And I know of no authority in Texas law which allows an appellate court to mandamus a trial court in order to prevent a breach of contract, which is what I understand that you're asking for if we don't look at it as an arbitration clause. You're saying they're breaching the contract, they don't have any business being in court, we want you to mandamus the trial judge to make them perform under the contract. And I don't know of any authority in Texas law that allows us to intervene in a breach of contract action in that way.
Well, in Walker v. Packer, in the discovery context, this court articulated a number of reasons why a remedy of law by appeal wasn't adequate for failure to obtain discovery. One of those grounds was that the order of the trial court vitiates a claim or defense of the parties. A defense to not only the breach of contract claim in this case, but the extra contractual claims will be the estoppel to contest the amount of the loss. It is my opinion that the extra contractual claims depend.
Well, go back to my question, though. What you're asking us to do is meant to intervene in a lawsuit, what you say is a breach of contract claim, and order the trial court to order a party to perform under the contract.
Yes.
And what authority is there, if that really is what's going on here, for us to start mandamusing to avoid breaches of contract?
Well, we're not asking to avoid, or we're not asking you to mandamus a breach of contract. We are telling the court that not only does this vitiate a defense, but it's not an error that can be corrected on appeal, because on appeal, the appellate court can't supply the appraisal. Third, the appraisal...
No, but the appellate court can send it back to the trial court after an appeal for an appraisal to be done and for the case to be disposed of in that way.
Which makes this analogous, again, to the relief sought in England.
Well, but then we're back to the fact that what we've got is you're asking us, then it is like an arbitration, because you're asking us to order an alternative dispute resolution procedure that is like an arbitration because you say it will dispose of the claim. Which is exactly what arbitration does. So maybe this is an arbitration clause.
No.
I mean, I'm just getting caught both ways, and I'm trying to figure out where you would have us walk the line in terms of that. I'm just confused about it.
I think the walking the line is simply a function of the fact that this is the party's agreement. We have the no-action clause in the policy. And that to do otherwise than stay the proceeding under the no-action clause then gives the control of whether or not the appraisal is going to take place to the insured.
Let me ask you about that. The way you stated that, the no-action clause in your policy, sounds to me like it's not a jurisdictional requirement for subject matter jurisdiction of the trial court. Do you agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree with that.
So your argument now has to do with the trial court abused its discretion by not staying the trial.
Yes, Your Honor.
Granting your plea in abatement.
Yes, Your Honor.
And don't we have law that says that a plea in abatement ruling is an incidental trial ruling not subject to mandamus?
Arbor v. Black says that.
Yes, and Pope versus Ferguson in about six more cases.
Yes, Your Honor. But our position here is assuming that it is an appraisal clause and it is enforceable as such, should the court stay it, is going back to Walker v. Packer, that this will not be a part of the record for appeal, cannot be corrected on appeal, and it vitiates
your,
the
your
defense.
Argument is, as I understand it, this is not a discovery dispute. This is not a situation where you get into trial and the trial judge could ultimately decide, well, you can have your expert go and appraise this car and give me that value. Your argument is not this is a discovery dispute. There is a legal effect under the contract through an appraisal.
Yes,
that
Your Honor.
Appraisal comes back. There is a legal effect to that that determines one or more of the issues that will be tried in this case.
That is correct.
And so even if there's an extra contractual claim out there that's being sued on, or delay in a payment, or a failure to deny timely, or any of those other issues, one of the issues in this case will be affected by this appraisal. that if the court refuses to compel the appraisal under the contract, then on appeal it is not a matter that the appellate court can correct. It only results in another trial of the case.
That is correct, Your Honor.
With an appraisal at that trial.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the whole purpose of having this in the contract was in favor of the parties not having to have a new trial on that issue.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And so if the court does not compel it at this point, that is the valuable right under the contract that was contracted for, agreed to, that will have been lost.
That's correct, Your Honor.
What legal effect would an appraisal have here? That's what I'm having trouble with.
The legal effect under the Texas cases, which are cited in our brief, is that it stops.
Stops what?
A party from contesting the amount of the loss.
What amount of the loss? All right, let's say they drop their amount of the loss claims. You've still got the extra contractual claims.
I would submit, Your Honor, that if they
and
drop...
And then it becomes a relevancy issue as to the extra contractual claims.
I would submit, Your Honor, that if they drop the contractual claims, they don't have their extra contractual claims. Because their extra contractual claims, each and every one, hinge upon a dispute about the amount of the loss. Whether you label that...
But they don't hinge on the amount of the loss as determined by the appraisal process, which is a dispute resolution procedure. Their claims hinge on how the insurance company values the claim at the point in time the claim is made and does their take-it-or-leave-it offer to the insured. I mean, I have the same problem Justice O'Neill is having with respect to relevancy, because the appraisal process is a means for the insured and the insurance company to compromise when there is a dispute. But that's not what they're complaining about here. They're complaining about how you valued in the first instance. And when you gave them that value, you said, and that's it, your other rights under the policy for your rental car, et cetera, are going to go away, so take it or leave it. So I don't see how the amount of loss is relevant to those claims, which puts me back to where Justice O'Neill is questioning.
Well, first, I don't believe the record indicates, other than the bare allegations of the plaintiffs, that it was take it or leave it.
That's not exactly correct. There's an exhibit to one of the motions, a letter from Farmers that says, if you don't take this amount of money, please be advised that we will no longer be responsible for any additional storage charge after a certain date, and fees incurred after the date will be deducted from any settlement, et cetera. So there is some basis for that, I thought.
And that same letter provides that if you have any additional information you would like to provide us with the value, please provide it. At the same time, it's not a take it or leave it from the standpoint of if the insurer...
My point is, I think you need to address Justice Hankin, at least from my perspective, address her question about whether, even if we're not talking about amount of loss, aren't there other claims that the plaintiffs are making here for damages outside of this appraisal issue?
Yes, but I believe they all hinge upon whether or not the insured can make a breach of contract claim. And if the appraisal comes back at the amount of the actual cash value determined by the insurer, there is no breach of contract claim.
So the insurer is permitted, under your theory, to withdraw other benefits of the contract pending final resolution of the appraisal claim, and that is not a damage that the plaintiffs can sue upon.
The insurance contract provides that those benefits stop when the loss is paid. In the case of Renita Washington, the loss was, who is the farmer's insured, the loss was paid to her lien holder, and until this lawsuit was filed, Farmers had no knowledge that she disputed the amount of the loss. And until that dispute as to the amount of loss occurs, Farmers doesn't know it has to invoke or may invoke the appraisal clause. Because the appraisal clause provides, if you or we disagree as to the amount of loss. But her claim was paid, she accepted the payment, the lien was paid, and 2 months later, the lawsuit was filed, which was the first notice Farmers had that the amount of loss was in dispute, and thrown in with the breach of contract claim were all the extra contractual claims challenging the process for determining the amount of loss writ large.
Mr. Rogers, all of your references to the appraisal clause and the way you present it and the legal context in which you put it make it sound like an arbitration clause. I know your time is up, and just in 2 minutes or less, can you tell us why legally this should not be treated like an arbitration clause, since it seems to me the way that you would apply it in this context would cause it to work that way?
Yes, Judge. Historically, in Texas, prior to the adoption of the Texas Arbitration Act, courts looked with disfavor upon agreements to arbitrate future disputes as ousting the courts of jurisdiction. Even in that time, pre-1965, however, the courts made and observed a distinction between appraisal on the one hand and arbitration on the other. Appraisal does just that, appraise. The word appraisal comes from the Middle English apprisin, A-P-P-R-E-S-I-N, which is a modification of prize, which means to value. The word arbitration comes from the Latin arbitratus, which is the past participle of arbitrari, which means to judge. That points up the fundamental distinction between appraisal, to set value, and to arbitrate, judge, on the other hand. Appraisal does nothing but determine the value of the loss. An arbitration proceeding involves what the courts used to characterize as asking the courts of jurisdiction, but as this court observed in, I believe it was Anglin, and its definition of appraisal or arbitration, it was a resolution of the dispute outside the tribunal and normal processes of law.
But you say that the appraisal process acts as an estoppel, and I take it that you mean by that that once the appraisal process, the valuing has been done by either two or the third arbitrator, and that value has been determined, that it acts as an estoppel and that determination is binding upon the insured and the insurance company.
Yes, Your Honor.
So why isn't that then, while it may involve determining value, why isn't the ultimate result to judge the value in a binding way to resolve the dispute?
It does judge value in a binding way.
Then why isn't it, by the definitions you just gave us, an arbitration clause?
It doesn't determine liability. It doesn't determine causation. It doesn't determine coverage. It doesn't determine any of the other extra contractual claims.
But can't arbitration apply? To arbitrate something does not require someone to arbitrate the entirety of a matter. You can arbitrate pieces of a matter. Well, I don't understand. Where is there a definition of arbitration that requires the entirety of the claim to be done?
Typically, arbitration involves resolution of a dispute in a very, very, very narrow sense. One could regard the appraisal clause as an agreement to arbitrate the amount of a loss.
And you've told us that once the insurance company is allowed to invoke that procedure in these cases, that will in fact resolve the dispute with these insureds as to their contractual claims.
It may have the effect of that, but it's going to be up to the judge and jury to determine whether or not that determination of the amount of loss affects the extra contractual
claim.
Okay,
but as to the contractual claim, it's going to resolve the contractual claim in its entirety. That's your interpretation of the policy.
It's going to resolve the amount of loss. It is still going to be up for the judge and jury to determine whether or not there's a breach of contract. The appraisal clause does not resolve that issue.
Well, but the insurance company in these cases has acknowledged coverage.
Yes,
and the only dispute that remains with respect to the insurance policy itself is as to the amount to be paid under the policy.
The amount of loss.
So the amount of loss, which is the amount to be paid.
Yes.
So that really, in this instance, the use of the appraisal clause will operate to resolve that particular dispute in its entirety between the insured and the insurance company.
Only insofar as if it's favorable to the insurer can then take the appraisal and go to the court and move for summary judgment.
No, that wasn't my question. I'm just talking about if you carve out the one claim in the pleadings that is breach of contract, you need to pay me the loss under the policy, it will resolve that claim in its entirety.
It resolves the amount of loss, Judge. It doesn't resolve the cause of action. You still have to go back to the courthouse because the appraisers can't rule That is not a breach of contract.
But I understand that. No, I understand that. But it resolves all matters as between the two parties so that a final disposition of that claim is made.
It resolves all matters as between the two parties as to the amount of loss.
Thank you.
And that's all of it.
Assuming we were to say that this is an arbitration clause, what evidence is there in the record that this transaction falls into the federal arbitration?
The business of insurance, per se, is a business affecting interstate commerce. In the record, in this case...
Do you have a case that says that?
Yes, Your Honor. United States versus Southeastern Underwriters Association, which is cited in Hartford Insurance Company of the Midwest versus Wolf's Computer in the plaintiff's briefing. It's 322 U.S. 533. There in 1944, the United States Supreme Court said that modern insurance business functions as a result of interrelationship, interdependence, and integration of activities in all states where companies operate. In this case, the Allstate insurers are Illinois companies. The Progressive insurers are Ohio companies. Farmers Insurance Exchange is a California reciprocal or interinsurance exchange, which is or has the citizenship of its members, which are its policyholders who own the company, and they're the citizens of 29 states. Mid-Century Insurance Company is a California stock corporation. They're all licensed to do the business of insurance in Texas. Lastly, the plaintiffs, if we understand their allegation, their petition correctly, are attempting to certify nationwide class claims. So, insurance business clearly involves interstate commerce. The courts have historically found that. The record supports the finding in this case, should the court find it to be an arbitration agreement, that then the Federal Arbitration Act would apply. As this court has previously noted, the Federal Arbitration Act extends to the full extent of the Congress's power under the Commerce Clause of the United States Constitution and preempts state law. We still submit it is an appraisal clause.
Quick question. Your motion to enforce the appraisal provision and your plan abatement, I don't have it in front of me. I've not read it. But the motion itself, did it word the request for enforcement as an arbitration?
No. The parties moved in their pleas and abatement and demands for appraisal.
Let me ask you another question before you finish your answer. An appraisal could still be ordered by the trial court.
Yes,
the trial court, as a matter of discovery, could still say, yes, it's relevant and you're entitled to an appraisal, but I'm not going to abate while that occurs, and may disagree with you in terms of the effect of what an appraisal would be.
I think if a case proceeds down the road, as it did in In Re Terra Nova, which was decided by the Texarkana Court of Appeals, that at some point in the proceeding, if the insurer or insured early on doesn't make a demand for appraisal, trial court does have the discretion to decide, we're not going to determine the appraisal issue
yet. But has the trial court here said, no way, no how am I ever going to allow an appraisal to take place?
Which is what the trial court did here.
Do we have that in the record?
The trial court here found that as an appraisal provision, it is unenforceable.
As an arbitration?
Yes.
All right. But again, if we disagree with that, then the court has not foreclosed that as a matter of discovery.
I think, Judge, it's more than a matter of discovery.
And we may disagree on that, but the trial court has not completely foreclosed the possibility of an appraisal.
Well, as I understand the trial court's order, and having participated in the proceedings of the trial court made it abundantly clear that in this proceeding, this appraisal clause is of no force and effect, and no appraisal will ever take place. And he hinged that on some testimony that Professor Jack Ratliff made in a proceeding.
Do we have this in the record?
Yes, Your Honor. It's the Allstate Trapasso case, which was a class certification hearing that was going on in Judge Mahaffey's court the week before we appeared on one of the first motions. And it was a diminution in value case. And at the end of, and Professor Arthur Miller was there too.
Well, we have that in this case, that's in our record?
The testimony of Professor Ratliff is.
It is in our record.
Yes, Your Honor. At the end of his expert testimony on whether or not the case should be certified, Judge Mahaffey just simply asked him a question about the appraisal clause.
I think you've answered our question.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Judge.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Lee Godfrey will present argument for the respondent.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, thank you. And the answer was, Professor Ratliff, to that question that's in the record, looks like an arbitration to me.
If this is an arbitration, why aren't we compelled under the Federal Arbitration Act to say go arbitrate?
Justice Owen, the it is not established in this record that this controversy, this issue, is subject to the Federal Arbitration Act. In fact, there is no submission in the record at all, period.
We know
there's no basis in the record that the relators have put into the record that this involves interstate commerce.
Is it not undisputed that they are out-of-state insurers?
These are, some of the insurers are out-of-state, some of them are in-state, all of the policyholders are in-state, all of them are policies insuring Texas automobiles. And the cases, including the one out of the first court in Houston that was tried in Judge Mizell's court, and then went up, Justice Nuccio wrote the opinion, said, the federal act is not applicable because there is no evidence in this record, and that was a title insurance case. There is nothing in this record to support a finding that this case involves interstate commerce.
What about the cases he cited from the U.S. Supreme Court? Do they say that?
Frankly, Your Honor, in due respect, I don't think that those cases are apposite. It is still a matter of state law. Even if the federal act would be implicated for the party seeking to compel arbitration under the federal act to show evidence in the record that the transactions in question involve interstate commerce, and they haven't done it.
Let's talk about the merits real quickly. Assuming that there had been an appraisal, and the appraisal was exactly what the three insurance companies had offered from the get-go, what does that do to your extra-contractual claim?
It doesn't do anything, Your Honor.
What damages?
Our damages for the several extra-contractual causes of action that are pleaded are not limited to an appraisal or arbitration-based calculation of the amount of loss. Just like, for example,
can you tell me what damages specifically?
What these claims are is a complaint that, contrary to the terms of the policy, where the insurance company has an obligation to, in the first instance, make a good faith determination of the amount of loss.
Let's say in this case they did that. The appraiser says, yes, the value of the car was exactly what the insurance company initially valued at it. So there's, in this case at least, as to your plaintiffs.
We have pleaded, Your Honor, and we believe we are entitled, even if by chance there had been an appraisal, and I'll come back to this in a minute. Even if there had been an appraisal before the insurance company purported to discharge its obligation under the policy, which there wasn't. For Ms. Washington, Ms. Fernandez, there has never been any appraisal
but the insurance company purports. We disagree with you. We say there's got to be an appraisal. The appraisers come back and say the insurance company offered either more or exactly the amount of what these cars were worth.
Your Honor,
so that the insurance company did act in good faith. Now, what does that do to your extra contractual claim?
Nothing, Your Honor.
What damages would you be entitled to?
We would be entitled if we can show, pursuant to the claims that we have pleaded, that this so-called determination of loss by the insurance company that precipitates their first offer to us.
But let's assume their first offer was exactly what the appraiser says the car was worth. What damages have you suffered because of the process?
Because, Your Honor, we have been forced, because of the way in which they have applied the policy, the way in which they have undertaken their investigation and calculation of what is supposed to be, not some, this is the first party insurance contract.
Right.
We're not settling with the liability insurer.
But where's the breach?
The breach, Your Honor, is
they offer you exactly what the cars were.
The breach takes place, Your Honor, at the point where they purport to have given us an honest, good faith determination of actual loss of value.
And the appraiser says that's exactly what they did. Now, what are your damages?
Our damages are that we have been compelled, among other things, our damages are we have been forced to go through a so-called appraisal process where we have to hire an appraiser. We have to bear half the cost of the process. We have all of the blood, sweat, and tears associated with delay in getting that resolution, including they're telling us if you don't take what we are telling you is a good faith determination of amount of loss, not a settlement offer. If you don't take it, forget any other rights you have under this policy.
Where do you have the contractual right if the insurance company offers you full value for your car to indefinitely drag it out and say, well, I disagree, so I get a rental car value for a year or two, and you've got to store my car until we go through this process. Then the appraiser tells the insurer, you were offered exactly what your car was worth from the beginning. You're saying you're nevertheless entitled to all of
it. Your Honor,
that.
What I'm saying, and I think that begs the question, due respect, what I'm saying is that the case that we have pleaded and intend to prove is that they breached the insurance contract at the point where they gave us an ultimatum coupled with what they said was a good faith, honest determination of the amount of loss, not something less than that that they would like for us to settle for, but this they are telling us, this is the number.
Let me ask you a question, a variation on the thing. If I understand the claim, it is your belief that the insurance companies use a mechanism or a method or some advisors who necessarily always intentionally lowball the value of the property. That's your
absolutely.
That's your claim.
Yes, sir.
And the contract that your individual plaintiffs have signed under the insuring agreement anticipates that there could be a bona fide dispute over the value of the property. Now, I understand your claim is this isn't their offer is not bona fide.
Yes, sir.
But the contract you signed at least anticipates that you will have a dispute with the insurer over the value of that property.
The contract has a
mechanism.
Says if there is a good faith disagreement, in so many words, about what the amount of loss is.
But it anticipates that I've got this broken down, I've got this wrecked car over here, and it anticipates that I, as the owner, will have some just maybe reasonable, maybe unreasonable belief that this is just my little car here and it's really worth a lot of money to me, and the insurance company would necessarily not offer what it was worth to the owner. So it anticipates that we'll have this problem. So I will take it to my gas station attendant, my car repair place. The insurance company will have their hired gun, who's be their person, and we'll get some neutral appraiser and we'll put the three together and they will resolve between us value of that car. Now, I'm not going to go to a panel of three and I'm going to present my evidence. I'm just going to have I'm going to hire an expert who will be participating in the decision based on what they know. And that's going to decide what the cost of that value of that car is.
Yes.
If that
Exactly is what is wrong with what they do, is the suggestion that that's what is happening.
Okay.
That's precisely what is not happening.
So the contract that says that your plaintiff hire her or his expert, and the insurance company will hire their expert, and then there will be a third expert who's not hired by either side, and the three of them will then decide, I guess as we say now, the umpire then decides the value of that automobile, that it's $5,000. Your you're saying that with that as the right, and if that appraisal is the same value as the insurance company gave you initially, you still could claim that the offer was, as a matter of course, a low-balled offer, intentionally designed to hurt you. You could still claim
absolutely,
that.
Absolutely, Justice Sand. Assume that there is a piece of paper from Allstate to CCC that says, go do this vehicle valuation report, which is what it's called in the policy, and come back and give us a number that's 85% of that number. And we're going to tell the insured that we have a vehicle valuation report done by the biggest company in the world, and your vehicle's the amount of loss is $1,000, when they know that it is 115 or 120% of that figure. And the insured then is faced with the choice, believing, pursuant to the terms of the policy, that the insurance company has given them their own real good faith determination of what the loss is, of whether or not they're going to take advantage of this expensive and time-consuming process that you've just described. I say, we say, if we can prove that, and we believe we can, that as a matter of fact, there is a deliberate, pretextual, outcome-determinative scheme, just like in Summons, in this case, that they are deliberately telling people a lie about what the value of the vehicle is according to their own investigation, trying to save 15-20% on these thousands and thousands of transactions.
But even if that's the case, that's not a problem inherent in the appraisal process. It's just the way it's being used. And the
that's
trial judge
right,
in this case ruled that it's inherently unenforceable. The trial judge determined in this case you can't use this fraudulent, unfraudulent, 115%, 200%, it wouldn't matter.
What he said, Justice Hecht, what the order says, what the record says, is that he was not going to stay or abate the trial of the case to first have an appraisal. That's what he said.
Well, the part I'm referring to is where he says it's further ordered to judge and decree that the appraisal provision, when considered as an arbitration provision, is unenforceable.
Correct. And so, therefore...
So it wouldn't make any difference if it was fraudulently used or if the insurance company was handing out money. It's, in the trial judge's view, it's still unenforceable.
Which I agree with, Your Honor, that it is viewed as an arbitration provision unenforceable, and it should be viewed as an arbitration provision, although they do want to have it both ways, because obviously the Uniform Act, by its express terms, says you can submit anything you want to, basically. You can have a trial, you can have whatever you want. It's all unless as otherwise provided, and then it goes on to say everything that can happen in the arbitration.
But the effect of what we would decide today is that in every standard automobile policy, these clauses are unenforceable regardless of whether there's been a claim, bad faith or not, on the insurance company's part. They're just flat unenforceable.
Not necessarily, Justice Owen, because when this case goes back to the trial court, and I'm not saying, Your Honor, that it couldn't go back and say, we direct you to consider whether or not...
The trial court has said it's unenforceable. He says it's
let's say that you say, let's say that you say to the trial court...
And it's unenforceable.
We disagree that this is unenforceable.
No, but I'm saying based on what the trial court has held, and that's what you're asking us to agree with,
yes,
that these are an arbitration clause and that they are void or unenforceable, period. So that
correct.
They would no longer be enforceable in any auto policy in Texas.
They wouldn't be if, that's correct, Your Honor, that as a matter of the law of arbitration and what it takes to make one of them enforceable under the Arbitration Act, they would not be enforceable for not complying with the Arbitration Act.
I got a little bit confused in response to the question that Justice Hecht asked. The piece that you all are claiming is part of the fraudulent practice by the insurance company is what happens when the claim is made.
Correct.
You're not claiming that this arbitration or this appraisal clause, when it is invoked if there's a dispute later on, is in and of itself a fraudulent practice.
That's correct. We're not saying
that. It's the front end piece that you're complaining about.
We aren't saying that, as described in the policy, that this procedure is fraudulent or would be fraudulent. What we're saying is that before we ever get to that, and of course we never did get to it.
But my problem is you've agreed in the contract that what's going to be a reasonable good faith offer by the insurance company ultimately will be decided by this umpire if it comes to that. And so why aren't you bound by the umpire's decision? If the umpire says, yes, your offer was exactly cash value, why aren't you bound by that?
Your Honor, if we can't prove the breach of contract case, there's no question.
There may be ill motive, there may be ill will, but you actually got market value for your car.
That would be evidence upon which the trial court could certainly enter a ruling.
What are your damages? You've gotten your policy amount. What are your damages beyond?
Your Honor, if we prove our enhanced damages case, our fraud case, our DTPA case, our unconscionability case, all of which we've pleaded, if we prove those matters, whether or not someone should order an appraisal, for example, for Ms. Washington and Ms. Fernandez, where the insurance company has already purported to pay them what the insurance company fraudulently told them was the value of the car, doesn't have anything to do with whether or not in a good faith determination under an appraisal proceeding like this you could come out with a number that's the same thing as their original offer.
It's got to be, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but if the appraisal is, if there was a decision intentionally to underbid the value of the car up front, then it would seem to me the probabilities are that the appraisal would come at a number different than what the insurance company offered. 20% higher, 25% higher. It seems to me that would happen. And that would...
There may be ill motive, there may be ill will, but you actually got market value for your car.
That would be evidence upon which the trial court could certainly enter a ruling.
What are your damages? You got in your policy amount. What are your damages beyond that?
Your Honor, if we prove our enhanced damages case, our fraud case, our DTPA case, our unconscionability case, all of which we pleaded, if we prove those matters, whether or not someone should order an appraisal, for example, for Ms. Washington and Ms. Fernandez, where the insurance company has already purported to pay them what the insurance company fraudulently told them was the value of the car, doesn't have anything to do with whether or not in a good faith determination under an appraisal proceeding like this you could come out with a number that's the same thing as their original offer.
It's got to be, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but if the appraisal is, if there was a decision intentionally to underbid the value of the car up front, then it would seem to me the probabilities are that the appraisal would come at a number different than what the insurance company offered. 20% higher, 25% higher. It seems to me that would happen, and that would, the position you take, it almost dictate that that would happen through the umpire. There'd be, because the umpire would be deciding market value as opposed to an 85% of market value decision. So it'd be more. Do you agree, though, with the insurance company that the appraisal does have a legal effect, that the result of that appraisal has a legal effect affecting the rights of the parties under the contract, that the parties to the contract lose if the trial court simply relegates the appraisal to just a discovery matter as opposed to a contract matter?
Your Honor, I don't agree that the appraisal proceeding, properly construed, should be binding on the parties of the trial court, because I believe it's an unenforceable arbitration provision. But if the court decided that it is an enforceable provision and instructed the trial court that this appraisal shall have the effect of determining amount of loss for vehicles subject to an appraisal, then obviously the argument of the insurance company, and they're already making it, is, and Justice Hankinson is right, there is no other issue with respect to the breach of contract claim itself other than the amount of loss. There's no reservation of rights. There's no denial of coverage. They don't even initiate this process until they've determined it's a covered auto, the insurance company. So it does dispose. It purports to dispose of the issue but on the contract between the insurance and the insurer. It does. But, Your Honor, our position is, this umpire is not. This whole process is tainted from the get-go. And we have been injured at the point where they give us this offer. Bear in mind, this money has been accepted by two of these three plaintiffs that are in front of the court. We're talking about ordering an appraisal of an automobile that the insurance company has already purported to pay under the terms of the policy for amount of loss on, pay the landowner.
And we're saying that this case down there, for these people can't proceed until now somebody goes back and has an appraisal of a vehicle that their position is, they've already paid the amount of loss.
Well, let me make sure I understand your damage construct, because I think that's what we're struggling with here. If it's someone who's already accepted that amount, your damages are going to be the difference between what you believe the insurance company ordered the appraisal to be and what she took.
Correct.
And in that instance, the appraisal provision is irrelevant to your damage construct.
Exactly.
If someone refuses that amount, then how do you get the damages if they refuse the amount the insurance company offered? How are you going to determine what they should have offered?
Well, in our submission, Your Honor, you determine it the way you determine any other case. But assuming that we're going to tell the trial judge that he needs to follow this procedure at some point.
Right.
In the litigation, and I'll come back to that.
Well, that was my original question, was if we were to hold that this is not an arbitration clause, then does it become a discovery matter for the trial court? I mean, isn't that something that you would then want as relevant to your claim?
Yes, Your Honor. This umpire has gotten handed to him or her, in the first instance under our submission, a fraudulent piece of information by the insurance company, a deliberate misstatement of what their own calculation shows the amount of loss to be.
Does that answer my question that I'm about to ask you, which is, why not do the appraisals now?
Why are you
asking the trial court not to order appraisals at this point in time?
Justice Hanks, in this case, and I know that there's panic in the streets over whether it would be a class action at some point, but this case is not about a bunch of people that are trying to get an appraisal. These people have taken the money, 99.9%. That's exactly what the procedure is designed to accomplish, is that you take the money. We happen to have one plaintiff here in the trial court who has not received the money. The others have. Their damages, we can either show that the amount they got differs from the company's own calculation that it made or should have made the market value, or we can't. And if we can show that, we have what the company has paid pursuant to the terms of the policy in the record. They paid it. There's no reason to go have an appraisal to see whether or not the company, which will, I promise the court, claim there is no issue, there is no dispute, there will never be an appraisal.
So
we've already paid and settled it.
So what standing do they have to complain about the validity, the enforceability of the appraisal process? That's the troublesome thing.
The people who, Your Honor, have
already took the money,
have received the money. If the carrier is insisting now that they go through an appraisal to show that what the company paid them was correct, they are having to undertake the time, the trouble, the expense, and everything else associated with that. If, on the other hand, Your Honor, in discovery, the proof is what I've suggested to the court, we believe it will be. We don't need an appraisal. We have the breach. We have damages. We have the enhanced damages.
That is your expert versus the company, and they're even independent umpire, which is what the parties contracted for.
No, ma'am, it's in my opinion, it's going to be the check they wrote.
You've got to have somebody come in and say, check that they wrote. But don't you also have someone come in and say, the check they wrote is less than the market value?
Less than what they say, what their own evaluation says the market value.
But what if everybody in the world agrees that they, for whatever reason, even though they intended to undervalue it, they actually paid the cash value, market value?
Your Honor, we can think up situations in which, as a result of discovery in the trial court, it ultimately was shown that notwithstanding what they intended to do, they messed up. And actually...
So even though you had no actual damages, they just paid damages for the ill will.
We paid for that, Your Honor. We've lost our other benefits under the policy, and we have paid to go through that process when the fact is, we believe, they know. They deliberately underpaid us in the first instance.
And as I understand from your pleadings, part of that is shown by the business practices and the way they actually arrived at the figure?
Yes, ma'am.
Is that right?
That's right.
How did that scam the umpire? I mean, the umpire briefed it. The third party neutral. How has the scam been pulled off?
If the umpire's in the record. Well, what's your claim?
The umpire is not, of course, in a position to determine anything with respect to their secret practices.
But the umpire is authorized to make an independent judgment of market value.
Yes.
And if they say that the insurance company paid you market value, how is a scam then promulgated?
It will be surprising in the extreme, just so, and if not knowing what these people did in the first instance, the umpire would not be tainted with and seriously influenced by the number that they give the umpire, which they know but he won't know, is different from their own real calculation of what the amount of loss is.
You're saying you just can't find an umpire that can make an independent
I'm saying that it is a there are a whole lot of fact questions involved with that issue that I think belong in the trial court. I mean, what do you do if we make our discovery, we find that indeed they were deliberately underbidding, what do you do then with the appraisal process? Did you tell the umpire that? Did you not tell the umpire that? I think those are issues that are in the province of the trial court.
Well, again, my question was going to be, I feel like I'm sitting on the trial court bench here talking about a discovery dispute. Back to my original question, if we disagree that this acts as an arbitration provision,
what power do we have to determine what's relevant to damages or not? I mean, you decide what that is, and the trial court rules, and you all take your chances as to whether we ultimately determine that that was correct. But it's not mandamusable, is it, at that point?
No, ma'am. I question why we're here also. I don't think that it's a proper matter of mandamus. I think these are discovery questions. These are some disputed fact issues about the relationship between the 99.9% of the people who accepted what they were told was vehicle valuation.
Well, and I guess my point is, if you argue that it's not relevant to your damage model, and the trial court agrees with you, it's not relevant to your damage model, and you take that chance, and it comes up to us, and we hold that it was relevant, then
I will what?
What does the opinion look like in this case if we disagree with Judge Mahaffey and determine that this is not an unenforceable arbitration clause? Then what does our opinion look like?
Well, if hopefully, Your Honor, looks like we don't agree that this appraisal provision properly should be construed as an arbitration agreement. It only decides part of the controversy, and it only decides the amount of loss and not the other issues with respect to breach of contract provision, all of which I disagree with. And so please take into account that the appraisal provision should be is enforceable, that the parties should have agreed to submit the issue of amount of loss to this appraisal proceeding, and please take further steps consistent with that. In essence, I don't think, Your Honor, it should say, nor do I think there's any basis for such an order to say you can't proceed with discovery on the issues in the case until and unless these people who were the insurance companies already paid them, for example,
you understand,
go through an appraisal procedure.
You understand that argument then? You view the order as having two parts. One, the arbitration versus appraisal, and secondly, the abatement.
Yes, sir.
So if I understood what you just said, then if we disagree with this, it's not, and if it's not an arbitration thing, then the trial court still doesn't have abuse of discretion in not abating the case.
Correct, Your Honor.
In other words, that our only mandamus jurisdiction is to review the arbitrability piece, and the rest of it is not subject to mandamus.
Yes, sir.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Please, the court. I think there are three issues that we've really been struggling with here today that all relate to each other. The issue about whether there are damages other than the amount of the loss, the issue about appraisal versus arbitration, and the issue about the remedy of law, they're really bound up together, and I think the result is going to be one that's going to require the court to grant the relief that we seek. Now, the issue about the amount of the loss, as we have indicated, there really are no damages beyond the amount of the loss if, in fact, the appraiser comes up and so the umpire comes up with the same decision that he had.
Except for the garbage-in, garbage-out theory. I mean, if all they have is a fundamentally defective, intentionally low offer from the insurance company, that's going to affect the umpire's decision, isn't it?
Not at all, Justice O'Neill, because an appraisal determines, it's an independent examination by experts as far as the value of the car. What we've got, and I think this really gets to the point that Justice Hankinson has been questioning about, this front-end piece is the problem. Well, what we've got is really no different than the situation of where an insurance says, insurance company, I don't like the fact that your insurance adjuster did not investigate A, B, C, and D. That's fraudulent. That's bad. It's a system with which I disagree. But at the end of the day, the question is, what's the amount of loss? The amount of loss is either $1,000 or it's $500 or whatever it is determined by this independent body. And if it's the amount that the insurance company said it was, then this is a Seinfeld case, a case about nothing.
Except for those who did not accept a payment. There were some who did not demand an appraisal and they took the money. And then it comes out that it was fixed, then the appraisals will be irrelevant to that determination.
That's not correct, Justice O'Neill, because there is a dispute about the amount of the loss. The fact that they took the money does not mean that there's no dispute about the amount of the loss. The petition specifically alleges that there's a dispute about the amount of the loss because they claim that the amount has been undervalued consistently and that they've not received actual cash value. And whenever there is a dispute about the amount of the loss, that's a subject for appraisal. Now, that leads into the next question.
Let me ask you this, though. Appraisal is a subjective process, correct?
Yes, there are objective factors one can look at, but at the end of the day, you've got individual humans making a subjective determination.
Which is why the policy had to account for the fact that the two appraisers might not agree, and so that's why you have to have an umpire, because ultimately that final determination is subjective. But as I understand the pleadings in this case, that's not what they're complaining about. They're complaining about the business practices of the insurance companies. For example, Triple C company or whatever?
CCC.
The company that's used to do these appraisals have been instructed by the carriers
to go out and when they determine value, to talk to dealers and find out the lowest amount that anyone was paying for a car, as opposed to any other way, and that there were various factors that were part of the test that always put everything at the low ball end, so that it's the objective piece, not the ultimate subjective piece that's part of the process that is being challenged here, which is why the question I think is being asked here about this, the front end piece.
But there's no difference between that, Justice Hutchinson, the situation where the insurance company says we are going to rely on the Red Book, which is one of the books that's used for determining value that it had sell. Is this subjective
determination? But this goes to the merits of the case in terms of what they're complaining about whether or not whatever it is that the insurance companies went to involved a concerted effort on the part of the companies to make sure that they were lowballing in terms of the amount that they were paying for loss, contrary to what they represented. So how then, if that's the claim, does that tie into the subjective determination of the amount of loss, which is the connection, I think, on relevancy that you all are trying to make?
Yeah, well, where it ties in is really merely from the point that one can allege extra contractual findings. One can allege a fraudulent scheme, but there is a contractual right that must be complied with in this case, and that's the appraisal provision. How it comes out may affect the case in different ways, and we're not here to determine that. We're simply here to enforce a provision that has not been enforced and will not ever be enforced under the trial court's determination. Now, that leads to the question, are we talking about an appraisal or an arbitration? I see my time is up, but if I could finish that point.
What's the answer to that?
The reality is, Justice F., is that courts, and this court's aware of it, courts have been confused about this issue for years, and it's not because of any one particular court. The United States Supreme Court, in fact, interpreted the issue 75 years ago in the Glidden case, and it was really an appraisal provision. They called it an arbitration. The fact is, both have very similar characteristics. Both accomplish a number of things in common. There are clear distinctions. This court has dealt with it in the Scottish Union case. Standard Fire versus Frame have dealt with it. But the reality is, on this arbitration, and in response to your question, one that Justice Hankinson has been dealing with, is that when the Fifth Circuit in Hartford versus Teachman analyzed the issue and said, we're not going to file the FAA. They did so because they determined that Texas law has held that appraisals are different from arbitrations, and they're not the same thing. If that's the case, clearly this order the mandamus has to be issued to correct the order. If it's not, mandamus still has to be issued because under the FAA we're entitled to the arbitration of the case being studied. So if this court is going to say, we now determine under Texas substantive law, despite 100 years of courts saying otherwise, that this is really an arbitration, that we move into trial court, that we believe we're entitled to relief under the FAA because there is interstate commerce, because the plenty of piece that Justice Hankinson is talking about, CCC, in the trial court's record, CCC is out of Chicago, Illinois, and did evaluations on a nationwide basis, and that's in the record, that's interstate commerce, and that supports a finding under the FAA, if this court is going to change Texas law, because CCC makes that connection.
That concludes the second argument.
All right.